for it.
Hello, welcome to this special edition of the podcast. I'm joined by Spencer from O-Varsity. How's it going, Spencer?
I'm pretty good. I'm very honored to be on, I guess, sort of what I consider, I mean, two of them are not here right now, but the OGs, I guess, of the Bearcats blogging game. Some of the guys that I was reading back when I first went to UC, and now I guess I'm like the second generation, you could say. So I'm very happy to be here.
I think your site is like probably the best one out there. Since I don't like write as much anymore.
Right. I think all you guys are like semi-retired almost.
Yeah, I think, yeah, Chris and Matt like definitely retired.
Yeah.
Like you're like there to like you and you're Matt. Like you guys are there to pick up the slack that was left and get written about by Mark Titus on his website.
Yeah, that was amazing. Me and Matt are both big Mark Titus fans, so that was like a big moment for us.
Yeah, he's probably like the biggest college basketball writer around, isn't he? Since like Seth Davis is like behind a paywall and
right. I mean,
Luke Wynn like retired.
Yeah, and as far as like college basketball writers that are like in our sort of sphere of like Twitter and social media, that type of thing. Yeah, I think all the bigger guys are like TV and newspapers.
And like, I just think he's like the funniest one. I guess like yeah, Parrish.
I really like him.
But like, nobody cares about the CBS people.
No.
I'm pretty sure some people do care. But I just like threw them under the bus. So the main reason I wanted to do this podcast was, besides like we've never talked before, is like the Bearcats are really awesome. And I had to talk about them with somebody. Like 23-2, 12-0 in the league, up to number 5 in the polls. Even though like the polls don't matter, still number 5. Like how excited have you been by this team? Like have they blown like past your expectations?
I wouldn't say they've blown past my expectations. I'd say it's mid-February and they've met my expectations, which, I mean, not to sound harsh, but that's like more than any UC team in the McCronin era has done. Because usually at some point they falter, and we go into a season saying, this might be a Final Four team, McCronin's best team, and usually they kind of slip up and don't quite meet that. But this team has met, if not exceeded, all the expectations we've had. And I think that's my biggest takeaway. I mean, the fact that we're number 5 in the country in mid-February is just such a long shot compared to even where we were at the end of the Big East. Like, that would have been hard for me to imagine.
Yeah, and this season just feels so much different than last season. Like, they have the same, like, almost similar gaudy records, except that team last year lost at SMU. And this team won, but like, it just feels different. Like last year, there was a gigantic drop off between how the team like played offensively in the non-conference, and then once conference play started. But this year, like there's been like a slight drop off, just because they play a lot slower still for whatever reason.
Yeah,
but like that drop off hasn't been there, and like they've just been demolishing everybody. It's been like kind of crazy to watch.
Yeah, I mean, we're in uncharted territory. I mean, just look at the numbers. Like, we've been 22-2 two previous years. We've never been 23-2. So, I mean, we're out in open waters, I guess. And like you said, it does feel different. Not only have they won 16 games in a row, but they're doing it easily, just blowing teams out. And the offense, even though it hasn't quite been where it was, you know, in the first 10 games of the season, the offense is, you know, better than we could have realistically expected in conference play, I feel like.
Yeah, like, part of it is because, like, they haven't actually played, like, Wichita State.
Yeah.
Who seems clearly, like, the second best team in the league, depending on how much you believe in Houston, I guess.
Yeah.
But still, like, even then, it's like the performance out of the players, I think, has been a lot different. Because, like, the last podcast I did, like, Matt and I like weren't really sold on like the team, like so. I guess it was like around the Temple game, or the first SMU game. But like the things like the turnovers, like that's gone down a ton. Like this team was turning the ball over nearly a quarter of the time, and now like they've got it down under 18%. Like, that was one of the biggest problems, like, stopping the offense from being incredibly efficient. It seems like something clicked where, like, everybody really, like, believes in their roles and, like, follows what Mick tells them. And, like, they all have it, like, figured out, at least for now. I don't want to jinx it now. Nah, I feel like I'm going too far.
I mean, I agree, though. I feel like, you know, like you said, right around that Temple game, things felt good, but, like, I don't think anyone was fully bought in with what this team was going to be able to do. But the offense, I think, has grown by leaps and bounds, both by reducing turnovers, and the defense has just reached another level, which forces turnovers and fast breaks and transition games that completely opens up the offense. And when you have a mediocre slash good offense that forces tons of turnovers, you can become a good offense. And that's pretty much what they've done. And I think the biggest thing that shocked me this year is the defense, because if you go back to November and October, every preview of the season, even by me, probably, I'll have to go look up and see what I said. Every preview of the season was, this is going to be a better offensive team. It's a matter of how much the defense is going to slack off. And if the defense can be close to what Mick Cronin is used to, then this is going to be a good team. And instead, here we are in mid-February, and the defense is one of the top five defenses in the last 15 years of college basketball. It's unbelievable.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the thing that really sets this team apart. Like everybody, like, made the connection between them and Virginia. Like, this year it seems like it's actually, like, true. Like, there's really no difference between what Virginia does and what Cincinnati's been doing.
No, not much.
And Virginia, like, their defense has just been insane. Like, people would talk about UC's defense a lot more if Virginia wasn't just, like, crazy.
Right. I mean, Virginia's having a historic defensive season, and the Bearcats are within reach and on a national level, I guess, aren't getting talked about nearly as much just because Virginia is doing things that nobody has ever seen before.
I think part of it is just because people really expect, like, UC to be a very good defensive team. At least, like, they have been under Cronin. Like, and, like, teams like Texas Tech and, like, Texas A&M are kind of, like, uncharted with how, like, big their improvements have been. It's kind of taking away the thunder a little bit.
Yeah, and I think that it may be because of the conference, but I think one of the most under-talked about stories on a national level is the fact that Mick Cronin, who is already one of the best defensive coaches in the country, brought in his best offensive team and has the best offensive team playing his best defensive game he's ever had in Cincinnati. And that's just blows me away.
That's actually a really great point. Because, like, some of these guys, like Cumberland and, like Evans to an extent, and then you could say the same thing about the guards, like Broom and Jennifer, like, mainly offensive, like, first players, especially Cumberland coming out of high school, and, like, his, like, improvement on the defensive end is, like, night and day compared to last season. Like, I really can't believe he's turned into as good a defender as he has.
Yeah, I mean, even you have guys like, if you go really into it, guys like Kane Broom and Justin Jennifer have both turned into very solid defenders, and those were guys who we assumed would be a huge liability going into the season.
Like, even earlier in the season, the Florida game, especially, like, when Chisora, I know he's, like, one of the best guards in the nation. Like, he just went one-on-one at Kane Broom until Mick took him out of the game late. That's, like, his improvement. I think ever since he's come off his injury, like, we've seen, like, a really different, like, version of Broom, which I think has been, like, really helpful for the team, because he's really, like, getting the offense going. And, like, sacrificing some of his numbers, because, like, we know he can score.
Yeah.
But, like, he's, like, pretty much just, like, kind of almost, like, pocketed that side of his game to, like, help everybody else get shots.
Yeah, and we're going to love having that next year, but it's awesome this year that that's sort of just taking a background and he's filling his role. And he easily could be out there mucking everything up and trying to score a bunch of points, but he realizes that this year that's not his job, and he's doing a great job of playing defense and distributing and making plays when he has to, and then next year when we actually need offense and need scoring, he can break out. But just the fact that he's been able to shelve that for a season has been just a huge pleasant surprise for me, because I anticipated that being a bit of an issue because of how much he shot at Sacred Heart.
Really, you could say how much he even shot during the non-conference. Like he's some big games, but at the same time, it was like guys got kind of waited around to see who was going to take charge, and like it's just been Gary Clark and Jacob Evans. Like, this is our team. Like, we're going to win and like jump on our backs. And like, that's like what they've done. It's kind of like, I really didn't think Jacob Evans would develop into like that type of like alpha dog on the team.
Right. Like, I mean, so many Mick Cronin guys, I feel like, have that issue where they're afraid to take charge, but it's been a pleasant surprise this year. I think how many guys are willing to take over. I mean, even Kyle Washington in the second half of games in these last, you know, 6, 7, 8 games has just been dominant, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, Kyle Washington, I don't think he's ever been like this consistent. Like,
no.
Like, what, 5 of his last 6 games, he's scored double digits. He used to be like the guy you could just look at the opponent and like, you know Kyle Washington's going to have a good game because that team has no front line.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's, like, really, like, blossomed his game. Like, yesterday against SMU, like, obviously they had no size. Like, they had no chance at guarding him. But, like, he had a really monster game. And, like, if you could, like, let him cook, like, 17 points, 18 minutes, like, that's...
It's unbelievable, especially with the efficiency, because last year that was the big knock against him, is that he's a great offensive player. Sometimes the efficiency just goes in the tank, and he'll shoot, like, 4 for 16 in a game, and you're just so frustrated. But this year, not only has he been more aggressive, but his efficiency has gone way up. He's shooting a crazy percentage over the last 6 or 7 games, and his defense is at a level it's never been. I mean, he's just twice the player he was this time last year.
And he's really brought it on the glass, which I think was one of the big knocks you could put on him last season.
Right.
Was like when the tough got going, like he wasn't an effective rebounder.
Yeah, what did he have, like 8 rebounds in 17 minutes last night or something? It was unbelievable.
Yeah, it's like, I think that was one of his like best games of his like entire career. And he only played like 20 minutes, 18 minutes. That brings up another thing that I think has been really interesting. It's been the rotations. Like, it seems like Mick has like finally like decided to switch up like the Clark and Washington, like who they play with. And like, we've seen a lot of like Washington and Brooks and Clark and or Washington and Scott and Brooks and Gary Clark, which I think is kind of interesting.
I mean, if you look at the makeup of this team, I think down the stretch, they're going to be so hard to prepare for because they have so many guys playing at a consistent level that are hard to plan against just because they're all different. Like, Naz Brooks brings you one thing, and Trayvon Scott brings you one thing, and Gary Clark obviously brings you one thing, and then Kyle Washington can, you know, shoot threes and play like a maniac sometimes. I mean, there are even just looking at the big men, there are 4 big men who are just 4 completely different players who are all firing when they need to be. And I think looking into March, if you're a team in the AAC tournament or even in the NCAA tournament and you're trying to predict what Mick Cronin's going to do, it's so hard because there's not just one thing they do.
And like you said, like they all give you something a little bit different. Like Brooks, like he's definitely going to like play defense and like mainly rebound, although he hasn't been afraid to shoot lately, which I think is a pretty good development. Like you can say like, oh, he hasn't like shot very well, which is true. But like the fact he's actually shooting shots, It says really a lot because he's like a pretty great offensive rebounder. And I think one of the knocks you could put on him was kind of the same thing you could say about like Gary Clark early in his career, would he get offensive rebounds and then turn around and not like, try to score.
I think new UC fans like don't remember that or weren't around to see that, but that was incredibly frustrating because Gary was the same beast on the offensive glass, but he'd catch it with nobody around and kick it outside to a shooter who was not going to make a shot, and you just wanted to tear your hair out.
Yeah, it's like, first, like, such a great player. Like, that was, like, one of the most frustrating things about his game, and, like, that's gone away. And, like, you, like, hope the same type of development can happen with Brooks. And I think we've really seen a lot with him. Like, just learning from Clark and Washington, because, like, that's something really he's got to do. He's going to play a ton of minutes next year.
Oh yeah.
What about Trey Scott? What stands out with his game with you?
I think the biggest thing for him, he's still rough around the edges, and I think he gets some flack from UC fans because of that. But I think he's sort of like the other players, is sort of learning his role, and he can come off the bench and do a variety of things. And I don't think he's necessarily forcing it anymore. He's not trying to get points. I think there's a game recently I pointed out, this was maybe 4 or 5 games ago. I wish I could remember which one, but he had, 4 points, 6 rebounds, 4 assists, and 2 blocks in like 10 minutes. And that's the type of player he is. He can do a little bit of everything, and he's aggressive, he'll play defense, but he's not the type of player who's going to force it. And I think that's huge for UC to have sort of a Swiss Army knife off the bench who can do a little bit of everything and doesn't try to do too much.
That's a great point, because like his vision, like it's something that he never really showed before. Like 6 assists in his, the last 2 games to 0 turnovers. Like he like scored 6 points the last 2 games on 3 of 8 shooting. He even took a three. Like he's like pulled down eight rebounds the last game, 5 rebounds against SMU. Like he's really been like just like given like time and minutes. I think playing with like one of the big stars has really helped him because like he doesn't have to do like much else besides just his part because like Gary's gonna post up or like Washington's gonna post up. Or even like Washington will just play outside and like Trey
Right.
Scott gets a chance to post up. I mean they were flashing him a lot in the top of the zone yesterday.
I enjoy the type of things they're doing, but I think the biggest development as far as why the team is succeeding as a whole, I think, is because those role players who are good in those roles now trust the stars to take care of their job. So you got Trey Scott out there. He's not trying to force up a shot because he knows that Jacob Evans or Gary Clark or Kyle Washington is going to make the shot. And that completely changes everything when you have guys settle into their roles because they know it's for the betterment of the team, and they're not worried that if I don't take the shot, no one else is going to take it.
That's a great point. I think that also goes the same way where, like, if you do all the little things, like, you know you're going to get the ball if, like, you're open. Like, this
Yeah.
team is, like, the assist rate has been, like, kind of crazy. Like, conference plays, like, over 62% of their, like, field goals are assisted on. Like, that number was pretty outstanding against SMU. I don't know
Yeah,
if the
well,
top of my head. It was 23 assists to, 28 field goals yesterday.
that's incredible, especially if you consider how UC looked with guys like Sean Kilpatrick out there, where they weren't passing the ball as much. It was the offense was running through one guy, and now they have it this year where they're not only are they moving it around, which they did that in the Big East days, they just kick it around the 3-point line until someone was open. But this year they're actually passing with a purpose, and you have guys passing up good shots for great shots, and that's something that we haven't seen before, like an actual offensive flow and like an intent to how passing works. I mean, it sounds fundamental, but for a team that's never been strong offensively, it's completely changed the outcome of the whole season.
Oh, 100%. Like UC used to be the type of team that you could just throw a zone against, and they would have no idea how to
Oh,
break it.
those Syracuse games would be terrible because everyone would stand out on the 3-point line. They'd pass it around in a half circle for 20 seconds, and then someone who got kind of open would just chuck one. And you could beat Syracuse if you're hitting outside shots. Otherwise, you didn't stand a chance.
Just remember, I don't remember how long ago it was now. Like the one game they played at Syracuse, like all they did was shoot threes, and they hit like 4 in a row, and took the lead, and then like they didn't make any more. They lost by like 25 points.
I mean, there was one where I want to say it was the 2012-2013 season, because I think it was Kashmir's senior year. And it was at the Carrier Dome, and they almost won it, but the offense went completely ice cold down the stretch because they couldn't hit any outside shots, and they weren't going to get anything else because, I mean, who do they have that year? Like Sheck Mudge? Like, you can't rely on him to beat some Syracuse big man.
Yeah, that game, 2013 season, they were 10 of 32 from 3, lost 57 to 55.
Yeah, that game was brutal because they shot ice cold and still almost pulled off that upset.
Kilpatrick was 6 of 15. Cash was 1 of 8 from 3. Like, unbelievable.
I mean, it feels like we're light years from that type of offense. Like, I almost have to go back and force myself to remember how the offense looked. I mean, even in the 2011-2012 season when they were beating teams, the offense was still super disjointed, and you'd have a bad shooting night and just lose. I mean, they lost to, like, South Florida and St. John's. Like, they lost to some bad teams that year.
They lost to Presbyterian that season, I believe.
And Marshall.
That Marshall game was kind of insane. I think Marshall like made 100 threes in that game. It's just my unofficial stats.
They might have.
What do you think has been like the most frustrating game of, like, as long as you've been a UC fan?
I mean, that Syracuse game is up there, but it's not the top. I'm trying to think. I think Harvard would be very close to the top just because of how good that team was, at least as far as the top-end talent they have. Harvard would be up there. I mean, there were so many they had in the 2015-2016 season when they lost all those heartbreakers. This team has played some super frustrating games since I've been a fan.
There was it 2015 or 2000, whatever they played St. Joe's, and
yep,
they couldn't dunk it in time to tie the game. That was brutal.
I seriously wanted to die. I was in New York City with my girlfriend. She was living in New York City at the time, and I went to visit her, and the plane landed. I like got to her apartment in time to watch like the last 15 minutes of that game maybe, and it was just, that was the first game after the 4 overtime UConn game. So that was just like, you never in the rest of your life as a UC fan will you lose back-to-back games in more heartbreaking fashion than that.
Yeah, that has to be like the like worst 1-2 punch that, like, it maybe ever. It's that UConn
game. I mean, seriously, they lost a game on like a 70-foot buzzer beater in triple overtime. I mean, that forced 4 OT, but that's where they lost the game. And then they went on to the next game and couldn't get a dunk off their fingertips in time. I mean, just two opposite ends of the spectrum and just equally excruciating. It was unbelievable.
And it just seemed one of those teams that, like, never caught a break. And then they just never caught a break. It's like the end of the season.
It was unbearable. I was so happy when that season was over. I seriously have never been through anything quite that heartbreaking.
In case people don't remember, they lost to Butler on a guy threw up like a 30-foot shot to like ice it, I believe, or give them the win. It was late. Iowa State made a three at the end to beat them. The SMU game, like, UC had a chance to tie or win, and like they didn't. They either didn't get a shot up or they shot a really terrible shot and lost.
There were some brutal games that year. They lost that Tulsa game by 2 or 3 points, I think, after Tulsa made like a 70-foot line drive at the end of the first half.
That's a double overtime game to Temple. Like, what a brutal season.
Anytime I feel like I'm losing sight of this season, I look back at how bad that was, where it seemed like we couldn't buy a break against even like Temple or Tulsa. Like, we were just getting snake bit at every turn. So just think back on that when you're losing sight of how fun this season is.
Exactly. Like, and like, this team hasn't even played like a really close game in so long, which is kind of like unsettling in the sense that, like, I'd kind of like them to play a close game to know what it's like. But then same time, like, if you're playing like SMU, like, with how depleted they are, or like Central Florida with their no offense, like, you want them to win by 30 points.
Right. I mean, it is kind of, it scares me how much we're winning by, but we're winning by, like you said, 30 points in games where we should win by 30 points. So, I mean, I guess it checks out. I'm not super worried, but half of me wonders if we're going to go into this stretch this week and, you know, you play Houston on the road and Wichita at home, and there's like, you know, a non-zero chance we lose both of those games. Like, I think we're going to have just a meltdown in the fan base, despite the fact that, hey, these are actually tough games harder than any games we've played in the last month.
And like really, like nobody since I would say Xavier played UC as hard as Houston did in the first half of that game.
No,
like
not
Houston,
at all.
Like Houston took it right to them, and like that game was like kind of crazy because like they could have easily have folded and lost that game, but then like they made a monster run at the end of the first half to get it close, and like they just like kind of blew Houston out the second half. And like
Yeah.
Houston made like a little run at the end, but like they wasn't really in doubt.
Yeah, I think that Houston game and then the game at Temple are like my two bits of like reassurance that this team has faced at least a little bit of adversity in this winning streak, because otherwise you look at it and you say, I mean, if you're winning by 20 points every game, which they are, I mean, the margin victory is like 21 points or something. If you're winning by that much every game, how can you possibly stay sharp no matter how much Mick Cronin is drilling it into them? So, I mean, they've played a couple tougher games in this stretch, but still, I'd like to see them go out to Houston on Thursday and win that game by 10 points. I think I'd feel a lot better.
Yeah, same here. But I think the game that really like made me like believe more was like when they went to UCF and won. Like that game was terrible. Like I don't think anybody would say that game was good. But that game was one they could have like easily have lost with how terribly they played on offense. But like then like they just like didn't let UCF get a shot like the last 10 minutes of the game. Like it was like a defensive like exhibition with like how great they played. Like obviously UCF's like offense is like one of the worst in the nation. Like doing that to anybody, like on the road.
Like yeah, I mean, and UCF was at full strength at that time. I mean, they had BJ Taylor back for that game, and that was when Taco Fall was healthy. So they went into that game. I was scared to death for that game. I was just full expecting exactly what happened. But then by the end of it, the Bearcats had pulled away by double digits for a good chunk of the second half in a game that I was expecting to be an absolute misery. By the end of it, wasn't nerve-wracking at all from my point of view, which that just achieving that I do think is reassuring.
What do you think is like, I guess Wichita State is obviously the hardest game left since that's on their senior day.
Yeah.
And whatever they do for like Landry Shamet. Like, do you think Houston is like definitely the second toughest game, or would you like pick a different game just to throw a curveball?
No, I think I'd go Houston as the second toughest this game on Thursday because, I mean, Houston, I think, is pretty clearly the number three team in the conference. It is on the road, and the Bearcats are coming off a streak where they've had basically nothing but success. So I think there's a chance that they can maybe overlook Houston a little bit. I don't know. But I do think that's the second toughest game left on the schedule, although I will say that Houston, like you said, threw everything they had at the Bearcats in the last game, and then the Bearcats came back and won, which proved to the team that, one, Houston can beat you. They have the ability to. And two, if you play your game, you can easily beat Houston. So I think that's reassuring, and the fact that Houston is not playing on campus this year. So even if it is a top five team coming to town and they pack it out, there's a very hard limit on how much home court advantage they can really have at the gym they're playing in, which makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah, I think that's one of the weirdest like storylines for the AAC this year, is like two of the best teams that aren't playing at home.
Yeah.
Like, so they have no real home court advantage, except like neither one of them has lost at home this year.
It is strange. And then you have Wichita, who's the other top three team, is in their first year in the conference. So the rest of the conference is going on the road to the top three teams in buildings they've never played in.
Yeah, that can't have happened like too many times.
No, that's got to be the first time ever. And now that I think about it, I wonder if that even helps those three teams, that the most talented teams in the conference are playing in buildings that none of the opponents have seen before. I mean, it's tough for the home team too, obviously playing away from the usual. I mean, not for Wichita, but maybe that does play a factor in why those three teams have been so good at home this year.
I kind of think it does. like outside of the SMU game, like which Wichita blew at home, like they've won like all the rest of their home games by double digits, like not even close.
Yeah.
Even like they like stomped Houston the first time they played them. That's an interesting point. Like that's going to be a really tough game for UC to play, just because like that atmosphere is like always crazy, and like you've never played there before. It's like learning like the new dimensions.
Yeah, I think that Wichita game is pretty scary just because the Bearcats have never played there. I mean, it's not like they're going on the road to a top 25 UConn or SMU team where they know the deal. They've done this a few years in a row. I mean, this is going to be uncharted territory. I mean, Wichita's a team they've only played once before, you know, because they'll have played them this Saturday. And then it's going to be senior day. And I think those three factors combined make that Wichita game to end the season pretty scary for me. I really don't know what to expect there. I think the Bearcats on KenPom are favored by 2 points, but I think that game is a toss-up at best.
Yeah, definitely. If like they end up dropping a game in the league, like that has to be the one like, right. You circle and highlight. Although like this Houston game like does worry me like quite a bit, because like we talked about, like they gave UC a tough run, and like Rob Gray didn't shoot very well in that first game. And I really like Rob Gray. Maybe I irrationally like his game. Like, I think he's going to win the conference player of the year. Do you? Or do you think it will be Gary Clark?
I don't think it'll be Gary. Maybe that's just me being a pessimist. I think Rob Gray is a very strong candidate because he's had a great season, and he's, you know, led his team to the tournament. I mean, that seems like that's where they're headed. Going into the year, I would not have predicted that Rob Gray would be playing this well necessarily, and I don't think I would have predicted that Houston would be in the tournament, and both of those things have happened. So, I mean, my vote obviously would be Gary, but if Rob Gray wins Player of the Year, I don't think I'll bat an eye at that.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Like, his offensive rating has gotten better every single year. Like, his assist rate is incredibly high. He's like, he's turned into their point guard this season. Like, I think the bias against, like, UC is, like, not, like, a real bias. Except, like, they kind of, like, cannibalize themselves. Like, the top five on KenPom, like, for Conference Player of the Year, or I guess all-conference team, are Clark, Evans, and Washington. So, like, nobody's going to vote for Washington, probably. So, it'd be no. Clark or Evans. And, like, if they split the vote at all, like, Rob Gray is going to have a pretty, like, easy shot to win.
Yeah, I don't know. Do they release the votes for that? Because I seriously think there's a high chance of that happening. I think probably Evans, Clark, and Gray are your top three in the conference right now. And I think if it comes down to that, I think that Evans will steal enough votes from Gary to give it to Rob Gray. I'm not sure if they release that or not. I think they might.
I don't think they do. They did not last year.
Right. Does it even say who's first, second, or third, though?
Yeah, it has the first. They only had the first and second teams last season.
Okay, yeah. Who knows then? But I do think that's a good point. I mean, you saw it going into the season where the Bearcats were picked to win the conference, which they're now running away with, so that was correct. And they didn't have a single player on the preseason first team all-conference. And now they, according to KenPom, have three of the top four. So they just completely cannibalize each other, where the consensus by other coaches in the league, at least going into the year, was that Cincinnati is going to be really good, but they're going to spread it around so well that I don't see them having one guy who will dominate from a statistical standpoint. And that's kind of true. I mean, Jacob and Gary have both had great years, but none of them are necessarily making waves on a national level like even Rob Gray is.
Yeah, which is... I think they'll have, like, Evans and Clark will make first team this year. Just because, like, the league has kind of been, like, killed by injuries.
Right.
But then, like, if, like, they were both second team, you would not be surprised. But you probably wouldn't be that surprised. Just because, like, their individual stats, like, kind of just, like, don't stand out with, like, them playing more, like, a team basketball.
Yeah, I mean, if Gary is not first team, I'll probably riot. If Kyle and Jacob are second team, I don't think I'd have an issue with that necessarily.
Clark is averaging, these are his season numbers, 12.8 points a game and 8.8 rebounds. So he should probably be like first team all conference.
I mean, what other big men are even in that neighborhood? I can't even think. I mean, Shaq Morris, Wichita. But other than that,
pretty much him, the Junior Itu of Tulane, or of Tulsa. Pardon. Like that's pretty much it. Nobody's gonna vote for Junior Itu.
No, not at all.
I guess one of the Tulane guys, Cameron Reynolds, is having a pretty good statistical season.
Like 15. I feel like Tulane's having a pretty good season, and I haven't even thought about them just because we only play them once this year and it's at the very end. So Tulane hasn't even crossed my mind, and I think they're playing better than I expected them to.
The Frazier and Renick Reynolds combo has been like pretty solid. Like Frazier, like, is in mock drafts. Like, he's averaging 16 points a game, like 5 rebounds. Like, then, like, they just like got like stomped by Houston. So it's like kind of hard to be too excited about them.
I mean, I think it's funny that when the schedule came out, we all rejoiced that we only had to play Tulane once. And in reality, I wish we could have only played UConn once, because Tulane is currently a probably better team than UConn is, at least on KenPom they are.
And they probably won't hurt your computer numbers as much as UConn will.
Right. UConn is just terrible. I can't get over it. They're 170 in KenPom right now. That's unbelievable. They're worse than every team in the conference but East Carolina and South Florida.
That's unbelievable.
If I told myself that after they won the championship in 2014, I would have laughed. That just doesn't even seem real.
Let's talk about that for a minute. Like I don't know. I just can't believe like how like badly that program has fallen. Like I thought Kevin Ollie was like an okay coach until last year. Like when things like bottomed out. Like you could like look at it and like maybe blame injuries and like I think like some of their recruits didn't get in. But, like this season's been a disaster. Like they have one player.
It's seriously almost reminds me of what happened with Tuberville. I think it's a little bit different, but I think the general vibe is pretty similar, that they had some success early. I mean, UConn had a lot of success, obviously. They won the national championship, but then they sort of had a perfect storm that derailed what should have been a pretty good season. And then this year, which all along was not going to be a very good season, is just an unmitigated disaster. And these UConn fans on Twitter have just completely lost their mind, which I've sort of backed off on harassing them just because I've been there with UC football. But when your team goes from being very good to being very bad in a short period of time, you completely lose all sanity. And I think my take on UConn's situation, with all their fans saying they should be in the Big East, is, first of all, yes, I mean, UConn fans are describing the same type of issues that Bearcat fans are describing, as far as attendance is down, revenue is down, recruiting is down, and that impacts a team on a larger scale. But in the short term, the only thing impacting the team is the fact that Kevin Ollie sucks. And so you can argue that the team on a larger scale should be in a better conference, but the conference affiliation has nothing to do with the fact that UConn is under 500 for the second year in a row. That's all Kevin Ollie. So you have to fix the coaching situation in the short term before you can address large picture issues like conference. And for some reason, they're skipping ahead to conference issues, which would be like if in Tuberville's last year, the team goes 4-8 and we're all just beating our heads against the table saying that we deserve to be in the Big Ten. That's about how much sense the UConn argument makes right now. And the team is so bad that all the fans have lost grip on reality.
I don't have anything to add to that. That was pretty thorough. I think that's kind of like the like push for them to get out of the league and join the Big Ten or Big East. Like, I wonder if like there's any like going to be any steam behind that in the off season. Like they're very unhappy just like with that and like the women's basketball. Like nobody's happy with this league when they're beating teams with like 80 points.
I mean, I don't see how they can even make that case at this point. Because even if UConn is a perfect fit for the league and the league would be willing to add them, is UConn going to at a team that's been under 500 in the American the last 2 years. And I know realignment has very little to do with recent success, but UConn's program on a large scale is headed for absolute disaster. And I don't think the Big East is going to extend an olive branch to try to save a program. I mean, that the American made that exact mistake when the Big East split up and saying, oh, these guys are a train wreck, but they're in a pretty good location and they've had some history. Let's bring them in. You can't use realignment as a way to rehabilitate a program, and UConn right now needs rehabilitation. I don't see the Big East going for a UConn move right now.
What would that do with their football team? Like, would their football team still be in the AAC, or would they go independent? I like haven't heard anybody talk about that point.
So I've heard some people talk about it, and I think the consensus is that football, UConn fans think they'd keep football in the American. And I think the American, if they have any balls, would say, absolutely not. Why would we want anything to do with UConn football if we're not at least getting UConn's brand for basketball? I mean, UConn football brings nothing. I mean, I'd rather have Toledo or Army or anybody in football other than UConn. So if UConn's not going to at least play basketball here and bring their fan base and their national brand, then I don't want anything to do with UConn otherwise outside of basketball.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more on that one. So, Mike, why would you just want UConn football to stick in the league? Like, they're like the only program, it seems like, where the like basketball like fuels like their like economy more than football does.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much. It's their whole athletic department is out of whack. I mean, the state and the university are bankrupt. They're stuck with Kevin Ollie, whose buyout is absurdly high. Whoever signed him to that, I think it's their current athletic director even. They're just in a mess, and I don't see how they can get out of it. They're stuck where they are, and the least they can do is find enough money to fire Kevin Ollie and at least get back on the right track before they can start to address larger issues, because UConn is standing on home plate with two strikes, claiming they just hit a triple.
How do you really feel?
I seriously, UConn fans on Twitter, I haven't always engaged them, but just UConn being bad is not only frustrating from a UC standpoint, but watching UConn fans completely melt down in the most nonsensical ways has forced me to really analyze how I feel about UConn's athletic department. So I've actually debated writing like a big blog post about here's UConn's issues, here's how people are reacting, and here's why that's wrong, here's what they should do, that type of thing, but I haven't gotten that far.
I think you should do it just to like piss off all the UConn fans.
Oh my gosh. It's unbelievable. I mean, I looked at it today. UConn would be like dead middle in the Colonial Athletic Association, and here they are talking about they need to be in the Big East. They're like 70 spots below DePaul, and they're arguing they should be in the Big East.
Like, really, like, you think if they joined, like, if they were in the Big East this year, their problems would be, like, a lot more, like, exacerbated because they would have a lot less wins. They wouldn't play East Carolina, Tulane, and South Florida, like, three of their league wins.
I mean, UConn fans are so delusional that if they were just back in the good old days in the Big East and they were just getting absolutely reamed day in and day out, they'd probably be happier than they are right now. So, I mean, they're just so in love with the idea of being in the Big East that they've completely lost their minds for everything else.
Yeah, I kind of think that's fair. Like, the conference realignment really, like, just threw them, like, completely out of everything.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I don't know.
Like, if, like, things didn't, like, happen, like, fall where they did, I wonder where UConn would be. They'd probably be a lot happier because they'd still be in the Big East.
Yeah. Yeah, I think they still probably would have hired Kevin Ollie and they would be terrible right now, but at least they'd have fans semi on board. It wouldn't seem like the sky is falling. It would just seem like they have a bad coach.
So you'd be like, oh, we're playing Georgetown.
Playing Syracuse and Georgetown, all three of us are bad, but it's fine because we're in the Big East.
Like the thing, like that does suck about like UConn and like even like Memphis to like a lesser extent sucking. Like what you said, like it just like reflects poorly on the league, because like UConn, Memphis, Cincinnati, and like I guess now Wichita State, like the big like names in the league, and like when half of them are like wandering through the wilderness. I guess Memphis is like not as terrible as everybody thought they would be, but they're just not interesting. Like Tubby Smith is like on the Tubber Bowl tour.
He is. I mean, I think that's maybe the most frustrating thing about the whole UConn dilemma is that all the fans are going crazy. This conference is terrible. We need to get out of here. And I want to be like, okay, well, what about me? We're actually doing what we're supposed to do. And you being so terrible is affecting my program as much as it's affecting your program. Like, I should be complaining too. So,
yeah, it's, I don't know. Like, it's kind of weird, like, how SMU has become, like, one of the better teams in the league throughout its, like, short history. Just because, like, that, just pushing everybody else, like, down a rung. Like, nobody really takes SMU basketball seriously, even when they have, like, Larry Brown. It's like, oh, look at what Larry Brown's doing. He's coaching SMU. Isn't that funny?
I think that has to be so frustrating for UConn fans, too, though, that SMU just manufactured a pretty dominant basketball program overnight, and UConn can't seem to beat anybody.
Yeah, that has to like definitely play in. Like all the retread coaches, like Kelvin Sampson's got a team at the top of the league.
That's just I mean, it seriously is a league. They hate Mick Cronin. Kelvin Sampson is a has been. Tubby Smith is a has been. Larry Brown, who was there, is a has been, and now all those teams have just completely left UConn. How annoying does that have to be if you're used to Jim Calhoun and national championships?
Like they're out here like losing to like Frank Haith teams. But making fun of UConn was a good detour.
Yeah, I didn't think that was going to turn into such a big topic.
What else in the league has, like, stood out to you? Like, is there anything that's kind of surprised you or, like, disappointed you?
You mean, like, this year or, like, as a whole? Are we still on big picture AAC or this season?
Let's do both. Big picture and, like, this season.
I think big picture, the biggest takeaways are that teams like, or programs, universities like Houston and SMU in football and basketball have come in here and flourish, and then teams we were banking on, like UConn and Memphis, and you know, even like USF, we figured, well, they're used to playing in the Big East, they'll come in and you know, take a step forward. I think those guys have completely tanked. So the fact that just the whole league from inception to now has gone topsy-turvy, but Cincinnati basketball is still the top, I think is a big storyline that I might not have believed, you know, in 2013 going into this. I think as far as this season, I mean, I guess we already sort of touched on the big stuff to me. I thought Wichita would be better than they are. I mean, I knew that they were going to have a bit of an adjustment coming into a league that's much better than they played in last year, but I thought they'd be sort of a game and a half back, like, I mean, down the whole stretch. I did not think at any point that Cincinnati would have a 3-game lead on the conference in mid-February. And other than that, I think Houston, I did not expect them to really turn the corner like they have, and I did not think Rob Gray was just going to be playing as strongly as he has.
I think the point about Houston, SMU, like, just, like, completely, like, flipping, like, what they were in Conference USA to being, like, upper-tier teams in football and in basketball.
Yeah.
It's like, been a really surprising development, because I don't think anybody was excited about, like, Houston football when, like, they joined the league. Like, obviously, they hit, like, a home run when they hired Tom Herman. But, like, basketball, like, people, like laughed when they hired Kelvin Sampson. Like, then he's, like, actually built up a program.
Right. I mean, it's crazy that here we are, you know, four seasons into the American, maybe five, I don't know, that we're to this point, and, you know, you could make a very good case that Houston has been the best university as far as an athletic standpoint goes. I mean, UConn won a national championship in basketball, and Cincinnati has been very consistently great in basketball, but football has sort of fallen off a little bit. But Houston, by and large, since the inception of the American, and they had a bad year or two in basketball, but otherwise they've been very strong in football and very strong in basketball. Just on both sides, I mean, Houston is doing a lot to hold up this conference, and I never in a million years would have guessed that in 2013.
Yeah, I wouldn't have either. Like, outside of that one, like, bad year they had, I think 2015. Like, they've been over 500 every year. Like, I guess you could have made a case like last year they were a bubble team. But like, they really weren't like a tournament team last year. I think my biggest surprise this year is kind of like a disappointment. And it's like Temple. Because Temple is good. Like, they have like great wins. Like, they beat Auburn and Clemson back to back. Like, I don't think anybody...
Those wins are incredible right now. They beat Auburn and Clemson in 3 days.
Yeah, and then, like, they had a really terrible, like, 5-game losing streak that kind of looks worse now. Like, UCF is terrible. Like, Tulane, like, has stopped playing well. But, like, they could be a tournament team if, like, they didn't, like, just, like, completely, like, trip and fall, like, in the end of December.
I mean, they lost to LaSalle, they lost to George Washington, they lost to Tulane, and they lost to Memphis. That's a lot of games, obviously, but if you get rid of the games they should not have lost, if they just take care of business and games they should win, I mean, the American has four tournament teams right now. I mean, Temple, talent-wise, is a much better team than their record shows, which is very frustrating as a fan of a team in the American.
They also beat Wichita State, and like they have a chance to go for the sweep against them this week, which would be really interesting if they were able to pull that one off. And like I think like just by X's and O's, like Fran is probably the best coach in the league, and like for them to like kind of like underachieve like again, like with like their talented players. Like last year they were what 500.
Yeah.
Like they have a lot of those guys back. Like Echenoia, like. It's really good, and so is Quentin Rose, but I don't know. It just seems like they don't always play that well. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I do think Fran Dunphy is a pretty good like in-game coach, like X's and O's, like you said, but I don't know how you can consistently underperform with the types of teams they've had in this conference. I mean, they haven't come into a conference where they're like a top two projected team, but they've come into a few seasons where you're like, okay, Temple's probably has a good shot at making the tournament, and it's completely fallen on its face. Somehow, Fran Dunphy has a big issue getting the most out of his teams, even though his teams have been pretty good.
Yeah, just really weird. They've only made the tournament once since they've been in the league. It seems like the opportunity was there for him to do it more than once.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the talent's been there. I think they're probably going to miss it this year, too, and this might be their most talented team since they've been in the conference.
They actually won the league in 2016.
I know, right? How weird is that looking back?
That's very, very weird. Who won that conference tournament? I don't even remember who won that one. Is that the one that UConn won it or something?
I think, yeah, that was when UConn won it. I think that was the year that. Yeah, that's right. That was the year they hit the long shot over us. They won in 4-0 and then went on. I mean, that game against us and then winning the conference tournament, obviously, against Temple is the only thing that got them into the tournament that year. Otherwise, we're looking at like four straight seasons where UConn hasn't made it.
SMU wasn't eligible to play in the tournament. They had a really great team. I felt bad for that team.
Yeah, the whole Larry Brown thing is hilarious because SMU was just like a rocket ship out of the gate, just pretty much dominating the American. And then Larry Brown, as quickly as he came, was out the door, and SMU has been pretty much screwed since. They've played pretty well through it, but this year it's really biting them.
Yeah, who knew like losing scholarships would hurt a basketball team with like a fixed amount of players on it?
I mean, that's what you get for hiring Larry Brown, though. Like, you're basically buying short-term success with the expectation that something is going to come back to bite you in the long run. I don't know what they thought was going to happen. I could have seen that coming from a mile away.
And, like, wasn't it just something really stupid where, like, they, like, just, like, fucked with somebody's, like, grades? Like, that guy still played on the team or something? I don't remember.
It was something dumb like that. But, I mean, just Larry Brown just doesn't care. Like, he was at the end of his career. He was going to do whatever it took to add a cherry on top of his legacy. And if at the end he got fired and got kicked out and SMU was ruined for the next 5 years, he didn't care at all. He was going to go sit on a beach or play golf.
It's really a shame because Nick, I really loved Nick Moore. He was a great player.
Oh, he killed us.
And never forget, UC cost that team a conference title. Is there anything else you want to get to? Like, I guess we should talk about the seeding thing. Like, since the committee put out their, I guess, top 16 seeds, UC ended up on the number two line as the last number two. Did you think that they would be on the two line, or like, what were you expecting going into it?
Going into it, I would have bet a lot of money that the Bearcats would have ended up as a three seed, and I probably would have leaned toward putting them as the top three seed. So I thought I was fairly certain that they would be number nine overall, you know, as the top three seed. So when they got that two seed, it was a fairly big shock for me because I thought it could have been within a spot or two of that number nine or number 10 spot. I did not think it would be up. So the fact that Cincinnati as a team in the American, as a team who has yet to play its three highest impact games of their conference slate, the fact that they're already a two seed at this stage, I think is incredibly encouraging to me because they're already better than what I was hoping for going into the season. And they still have huge games coming up, two against Wichita, who all year has been what we've circled, and then Thursday's road game against Houston, which is now, you know, a top three game of the conference slate for us.
The game against Houston, incredibly significant because, like, just on paper, that's their best win right now. That passed up the Buffalo win that everybody keeps knocking because Buffalo, like, played the RPI game and had a cap, an amazing RPI.
The RPI is so stupid. I mean, we're 23-2. We're number three in KenPom, and everyone is freaking out about the RPI, which says a game we played, you know, 4 months ago is the best win on our schedule. When anyone who's watched this team knows that, no, they played Houston pretty well. They won a big game on the road in Temple. They went on the road and beat UCLA and UCF. Like, there are more important wins, but the RPI is so screwed up that everyone's like, oh, Cincinnati is top five in the country and their best win is Buffalo. Like, that's any metric that says Buffalo is a top five team's best win is probably something that should be thrown out.
Yeah. Like Billis, when he was complaining about it, he was like, winning at Ryder is the same as winning at home against Villanova. Like, that doesn't sound right. But it is right with how the RPI works because, like, Ryder's top 75. And those, for some reason, are, like, important for road games. I don't know. I don't really like how they just, like, kept the RPI. Like, because the quadrant thing sounds like is interesting in theory. Like, they just was the same way of looking at the RPI. Like, it doesn't really change much.
I mean, I love the quadrants because then it puts weight on, if you go on the road and beat a team that's, you know, number 70, it's as important as beating a number 30 team at home. And I think that's smart. I like that they do that. But the fact that they based it on RPI completely ruins it almost for me. Because in general, I guess it lines up where the RPI is more or less how good a team is. But there are clear ways where that's not the case. And I think Buffalo is the perfect example. Like, no one who's actually watched this team would say, wow, the biggest win they have this year is Buffalo. But the RPI says that, and therefore that's going to weigh into the selection committee. So, I mean, in that sense, we saw what the committee was thinking, and putting us at a two seed clearly indicates that they're not thinking that Buffalo is our best win.
Just for comparison, Buffalo is about like 32 on the RPI.
33.
Yeah, the 33 ranked team on KenPom is Kentucky. Like, there's a kind of pretty gigantic difference between Buffalo and Kentucky.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I do think the team sheets are interesting because it plays well in Cincinnati's favor. I think I'll have to pull this up and reshare it. But I saw someone share a interview with someone on the committee who said that quadrant one and quadrant two wins are going to be very important. And the Bearcats in those two quadrants are 11-2, which I think is great. And I think that's probably a huge reason why they were a two seed and surprised some of us.
The only, like, I guess potential downside, like, maybe upside, is, like, if SMU, like, can somehow get back on track, that one would move back up, because UC knocked them out of the top 75 in RPI. So they lost one by stopping the hell out of SMU. Like, the rest of the way, you're not really going to get any low ones, because you have Wichita State, like, I think they're, like, top 20. Houston was top 30. Like, I guess like Tulsa is a road game, so that probably won't hurt too badly. Or no, that's a home game. Tulane is a
As a
road
road
game.
game. I mean, even Temple is close. We have a home win over Temple, who's number 40 right now. If they can get up to 30, then that's another quadrant one win.
Yeah, like with how like heavily they weighted that, like you said, like that's just another like huge advantage for UC. Because like UC doesn't have a top 25 like RPI win, which like in the past it seems like it would be like pretty serious,
Right.
but now they like pretty much get a break for it. Like really, like they're the only team, like in like the site I'm looking at is crashing the dance. They're the only team that doesn't have a top like 25 RPI win until like Wichita State also does not have a top 25 RPI win. And like them in Rhode Island, and like they're 19 and Cincinnati's number 4 on this. It's like a pretty big drop off.
Yeah, I mean, I think UC is catching a ton of breaks because even though they did lose, according to KenPom at least, they lost the top two toughest games on their schedule with Florida and Xavier. They've completely aced every mid-level game and also have a handful of solid wins mixed in there. So if the Bearcats had lost to a team, like Memphis, or you lose to East Carolina or lose a bad game, I think it'd be a lot easier to knock them. You say, oh, well, they lost a bad game and they also don't have a great win. But when the only knock against the team is that they've only won like 8 of their top 10 games, it's really hard to make a tough case against them. So I think down the stretch, that's going to be really important because the Bearcats can't afford to lose any game other than this Thursday or at Wichita, because otherwise people are going to start making a case against them that they don't have any elite wins.
And really, they can't really afford to lose both, or they'll probably be
No.
like a four seed.
Yeah, I think things are going to get dicey if they start losing. I don't anticipate that happening, but if they do lose, say if they lose, on the road to Wichita or on the road at Houston, and then they lose like the conference championship game, I still think they're a three seed. I think UC's in great shape. If they simply do what they should do based on their talent, I don't think there's any realistic chance they're below a three seed.
I think if they just make the conference championship game, that's enough. Because like now they played the last game before the
That's so
brackets are
stupid.
revealed. It's like, and we've learned from the Big Ten and the SEC, like that game doesn't matter. Like they already have the teams bracketed in. It's like they should probably already be seeded, like wherever they are, if they just make the title game.
That's true. I'd love to win out this regular season because I think that makes a really strong case if you run the table in your conference. And then if we can make the conference championship game and that doesn't weigh in at all, then I think the committee more or less is seeding us as a team that in mid-March has not lost since early December.
And with the like top 10 wins or like the quadrant wins, like they stand out even more. Like it's like because with a lot of these conferences like pretty much like cannibalizing themselves. Like so you see like it really doesn't have that. They just like just raking in all the like the nice things from teams who game the RPI system, like Buffalo.
Yeah, I'm happy for that Buffalo win. I'm not going to be the guy to make the case that that's our best win, but I'm very happy Buffalo is sneaky, had a good season.
Same here. Like we can't make fun of it, but like the fact remains, it was still a nice win. Like that game was really terrible. That probably was the most frustrating game of the season outside of Xavier.
It was. For a minute there, I really thought we were going to lose to Buffalo, and it was going to be like a here we go again type thing where we have a really good team who messes up a couple of games and ruins the whole season.
Because they tried really hard to lose to Buffalo.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I forgot to. I think people forget how terrible that game was. The Temple game may have passed it, but that Buffalo game was brutal, where I was starting to think that the sky was falling in the first 2 weeks of the season.
And they had 18 turnovers against 11 assists. Insane. They shot 39% on 2-point shots. But they went to the free throw line 35 times.
That
Like that does seem like the type of game they always lost the last few years, like the Rhode Island game last year.
Or that Ole Miss game. Do you remember that one in the holiday tournament?
Oh, my God. Yes.
Or that Nebraska, the 2-0 Nebraska game.
Oh. You want to talk about games that made me really mad. Like, that Nebraska game. That game was terrible, and it went to double overtime. Oh, my God.
That was one of the worst games I've ever seen UC play. But, yeah, I mean, it does seem like until this year, every UC team has, within the first month of the season, lost a game that they wish they could have back. And I think that was what that Buffalo game was about to be until they sort of stole back there.
Really? Like, you could say, like, they did that this year, except it was to Florida.
Right.
Not, like, anybody terrible.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very glad it was against Florida and not Buffalo or somebody else, but yeah. Yeah, I'd love to have that Florida game back.
I think they would too. And it seems like they used that game as, like, motivation, like, throughout, like, the rest of the season.
Yeah, I think that Florida game, the fact that we lost that may end up being a blessing in disguise. We'll never know for sure, but I think that game was a bit of a wake-up call. But still, though, you have to think that if we somehow pull off that Florida game, where are we right now? I mean, you know, if we're 24-1 and our only loss is to the number four team in the country, I can't even fathom where UC would be if they had managed to pull off a Florida game. That's like the only knock against them, is that they lost to a mediocre Florida team on a neutral floor.
That's a really great point. Like, they would probably have a chance for a one seed if they didn't blow that game. It's like, really, yeah. Like, the Xavier game, you can almost write off, like, a Xavier just, like, shot out their ass. And that game wasn't even close.
Yeah. Like, I mean, no one is going to knock you for losing to a top five team on the road, especially in a rivalry game.
And it's like, everybody remembers what happened after the game more than they remember what happened during the game now.
Right. No part of me is like, oh, I wish we could have that Xavier game back, or, oh, I'm really frustrated with how we played in that Xavier game. I don't even think about the game anymore because, on the grand scheme of things in our resume, is basically irrelevant. And I knew that at the time, too, so I was not exactly jumping off a cliff. I was more frustrated with the drama after the game than the game itself because, I mean, Xavier, as good as they are this year, and the fact that it was on the road, that's virtually irrelevant on our resume.
Let's talk about that real quick before we get out of here. Are you surprised that kind of just, like, blew over as fast as it did? I kind of thought that was going to last, like, all that drama was going to last a lot longer. And, like, after, like, the weekend, it was gone.
I think on one hand, I kind of expected it to be a very big, like, national story. Like, is the rivalry getting out of hand? Are things too serious? I thought we're going to have a mini brawl incident where everyone reevaluates the rivalry. On the other hand, because it was, like, a relatively minor incident and such a heated game, I think everyone was like, that's how it goes. I mean, we talked to Mark Titus on our podcast about it, and he said the exact same thing. He's like, oh, that's just how those games are. No one broke any rules or broke the law or assaulted anyone or did anything wrong necessarily. Emotions got really heated, and people embarrassed themselves after a really intense game. Like, that's nothing. It's not a big deal at all.
It's like the end result was people going like, oh, like, J.P. McHugh is, like, a dick, and Mick Cronin also a dick, and, like, that was how it ended.
Yeah, and everyone's like, well, those are two people doing what we expect them to do. Okay, when's the next game?
Like, the only time it's going to come up is next year, when people...
Exactly.
Except McHugh won't even be there, so they probably won't really bring it up that much, you would think. Unless, like, he somehow ended up on their coaching staff, which would be, like, the worst.
Can you imagine?
I kind of hope he does, just so, like, they have to, like, shake hands.
That kid's the worst. I don't even, like, make a policy of, like, hating other players, but J.P. McHugh has got my goat.
Because, like, he talks the most, and he's, like, not really good.
No, especially against UC. He's the biggest talker in all the UC games, and he's never played better than average against us. Like, he's the face of that rivalry over the past three seasons, and he hasn't even been good in those three games.
Yeah, he was, what, like, barely, like, seemed like he was on the floor this year.
Yeah, and we completely took him out of the game last year when we won. Blewett was on fire, and if McHugh could have gotten up off the mat and even, you know, had 12 points or 15 points or whatever, if he would have had a decent game, I think Xavier, that would have been a much closer game.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to use this time to say, I really like Trayvon Blewett. Like Shannon Russell's like article about him, like on The Athletic, was pretty good.
Yeah, I mean, there are Xavier guys in recent years who sometimes it feels good to say, you know what, I hate that team, but I will give that kid his respect. I think it makes me feel better about how much I hate Xavier that I can stop for a second and respect individual players. But I do have a lot of respect for Blewett. He's an incredible player, and outside of the stupid weed incident, he's never done anything wrong, especially on the court as far as trash talk. I felt the same way about, I think Edmund Sumner was kind of the same thing. I had a lot of respect for him. And then Matt Stainbrook, I really liked that guy.
I did too. He was an interesting guy. And like, so easy to make fun of, except like he rolled with it, which
right.
made it
that's,
even
that's
better.
That's what made it awesome. I mean, he's just some goofy guy. I would never want him on my team. I wasn't a fan of like his game necessarily. But he was like an Uber driver. He just seemed like a down-to-earth, like funny guy who just like was okay with being goofy and being like the butt of jokes. I liked him.
That guy, didn't like he light up somebody in the turn? He like lit up Arizona when like that
think,
like out
I think
of nowhere.
So. He had a couple big games.
Like, David West, I always liked David West when he was at Xavier. That's an old one, a retro grab.
Yeah, see, I wasn't around for the David West days, but I hated him as a pro. I mean, he's still around, obviously, but not really in the same sense. But he drives me crazy as an NBA player.
He, like nobody will ever be, like at least to me, like more hateable than Kevin Frey. Like if you lived like around those times when they always beat UC when UC was number one, it was the worst time in the world.
Yeah, I'll give you that one.
Like still remember last game in the Cincinnati Garden, like when they played each other and like Xavier won. When UC was number one, like he ran around the court like an idiot. Still makes me mad.
That is one thing I will say that drives. I have a lot of, I guess, issues with the rivalry. I think I have like a different view of it compared to other people. But one thing that just drives me crazy is that all the iconic moments in the game belong to Xavier, and that's because UC historically has always been better than Xavier has. So. I mean, you can't have an iconic moment against a program that's not as good as you are. And then when Xavier's finally gotten good, UC has had the yips or something. I don't know what's going on the last 3 or 4 years, but.
And one of the other things is, like, when Cincinnati beats Xavier, like, they, like, blow them out. Like, they don't win any of the close, like, interesting, like, games that stick in your mind. It's like, no. Oh, no, Cincinnati beat Xavier by, like, 15 points. So it's like, oh, well, that's cool. Like, every, like, overtime game, every like last second shot is like a Xavier game.
Yeah, I mean seriously, if you look back at all, just from a completely neutral standpoint, at like the top five games in the shootout, I think they're probably all Xavier wins.
Just look really terrible. except for like Mick Cronin's like what first year when they beat Xavier.
Yeah, that I think that was a moment just because Mick Cronin had nobody that year.
And, like, that Xavier team was, like pretty good, too.
Yeah.
Looking back on it, that was the team that should have beat Ohio State and, like, choked.
Yeah, they were good that year. So, I guess that was a big win. But other than that, I mean, I don't know really how much there is other than the fact, I mean, last year they beat them and Xavier ended up obviously going on that run. But for a while there, Xavier was so bad towards the end of that season that we were like, okay, we beat them, but they suck. Like, that's not worth anything.
Yeah, it was like, we beat them, but like, yeah. Oh, that should be a good win. And like, oh no, like they like lost like 5
oh, yes. Yeah, that was the worst Xavier move. Just we finally are able to beat them, and they just completely screwed us by tanking down the stretch, ruining our seed, and then blowing up to an Elite Eight. That was just the peak Xavier move.
Like how we ended up like just ripping on Xavier while we were talking about seeds.
Yeah, so yeah, the seed conversation quickly turned into talking about Xavier. I think we'd spent half this podcast talking about UConn and Xavier.
Just like that's how we know we're fans.
Quickly devolves into just like lowest common denominator. Our rivals suck.
That is like the rivals. Like that's the one thing like that really sucks about UConn being bad is like they're the only thing close to a rival in this league. Like when they're terrible, like it's just not fun. Like the Memphis rivalry was like for the old people. Like there's like nothing really.
I mean, from 2011 to 2015, all those UConn games were pretty great. They played a lot of classic games in that stretch. And my mentality was always, well, the American isn't that great, but at least, you know, those UConn games, those two teams are going to carry the banner, and they're always going to play tough games. Now, just blasting UConn four games in a row is just, it's fun in the sense that it's funny to laugh at UConn, but in the larger picture, I kind of wish we were still playing those intense, meaningful games like we did, you know, 3-4 years ago.
Yeah, that's the one thing that made the first year of the Americans so much fun. Like, Cincinnati was really good. UConn was, like, really good, obviously. Like, and that, Louisville was really good. SMU, like, was good out of nowhere. Like, Memphis ended up being a tournament team. Like, the rest of the league was garbage. So then, like, you would have, like, the round robin where, like, all the good teams played each other. Like, they were, like, all, like, the really great games.
I mean, there are so many big players in that league. Like, it's hard looking at where they are now to imagine the fact that there were three first-team All-Americans in this league 4 years ago.
Yeah, like Sean Kilpatrick didn't win a single award, which is still, like, unbelievable. Like, one, like, the National Player of the Year conversation guys, like, couldn't win a single award because, like, Russ Smith and Shabazz Napier were also in the league.
Yeah, I mean, Sean Kilpatrick has gone on to have a pretty solid pro career. He's one of the better players in UC history and wasn't even Player of the Year. Like, it's in a borderline mid-major conference.
It's insane. The KenPom Player of the Year that year was Russ Smith, according to the standings. And he didn't even win the Player of the Year because it was Shabazz.
And then Shabazz just put the team on his back and just, I've never seen a single player just will a team to a championship. I mean, Kevin Ollie, I've heard stories that the team basically revolted towards the end of that season, where it's like, follow me, Shabazz said, and then the whole team just streaked to a national championship while Kevin Ollie kind of just sat there.
That's crazy. And they had Boatwright. Boatwright was really great that year.
They had a few good players. Who was that? They had like a European guy. Yo. Some white guy. I forget his name. He was pretty good. Oh, Niles Giffey or something. What was his name?
Yeah, I think that was it.
And then Daniels was good. They had a good team.
I think he got drafted.
He did. I think he was I think he was like a second round pick.
That was also
he completely blew up in that tournament. He was not a great player that season, but blew up in that tournament, got himself drafted.
That was also the start of UC playing UConn like every single year in the conference tournament. Just really unfair to win the coin flip to be the number one seed.
Yeah.
Like,
Here's a frustrating game. I should have brought this up earlier. One of the most frustrating games, one of the most heartbreaking losses, was that 2014 AAC tournament against UConn when the Bearcats came all the way back and then SK missed a layup at the buzzer. I wanted to kill myself.
Oh, yeah, because then there's pictures of like, somebody like hitting the net or something.
And yeah.
Like, oh, that was goaltending, but they would never call that goaltending.
No. Yeah, that game was an absolute heartbreaker, and I think a lot of people have forgotten how terrible that was.
See, I thought you were going to say that Louisville game when like they reviewed like who the ball went off of. For, like,
oh, yeah, minutes. I mean, the Russ Smith game is the single most heartbreaking. I mean, I literally almost burst into tears in the student section that game, but I think people remember that. As far as like ones that people forget, that UConn game in the tournament was brutal. But yeah, that Russ Smith, that shot, I was so glad that the cameras didn't find me, because I would have been that stereotypical fan with his hands on his head looking like he was legitimately about to cry. That was my face.
That game, Sean Kilpatrick had 28 points and UC scored 57. What a game.
Yeah, I mean, that is probably the best environment I've seen at Fifth Third. I don't know. I was not around, obviously, during the Kenyon Martin days or the Steve Logan days, but out of every game I've seen at that arena, I think that takes the cake.
Yeah, that season, like, everybody really rallied around that team, especially Sean Kilpatrick. Like, he's ended up being, like, his, like, stars kind of, like, faded around UC the past couple years. I don't really know why.
Yeah.
Like, he was a really great player.
Probably he was awesome for UC. I mean, unfortunately, which just shows how ridiculous UC fans can be, I think a lot of the reason people are, like, down on him compared to where he was when he graduated is because he's, like, super corny on Twitter. And as dumb as that sounds, like, people are genuinely annoyed enough by that there are fewer, like, big Sean Kilpatrick fans than there were 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, I guess that...
That is like a real factor somehow.
Actually, that's really like the only way people can connect with some of those guys. What about Justin Jackson? Like, he just vanished. Whatever happened to him?
I think he's playing overseas, maybe. I follow him on Twitter, so I see a highlight roll by when he retweets one from his overseas team. I think he's doing all right.
Wasn't he at games in Florida?
Yeah, he was at the UCF game. The team, I think, tweeted a picture of him, and it was like, it made my whole day. I loved that guy.
I did too. Now this turned into like, oh, what about that guy?
we're terrible at staying on topic.
That's part of the joys of podcasting.
This podcast was like, you know, one third about this current season.
Now it's like easy to tell. We didn't really make an outline or anything. We started talking.
This is just a 90-minute conversation on just anything that comes to our mind about UC basketball.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'll let you go now. Do you have anything else that you want to say about this team or UC basketball in general?
I think we've covered it. I think the biggest takeaway I have is that I think everyone has the tendency to get so distracted by how national media and local media views UC, which I think has some merit, and I think I understand why people can get upset by that. But don't let that distract you from enjoying the best team that UC has had in 16 years. I mean, we're top five in the country. The fact that people are taking issue with local media or what channel the game airs on just seems so minor compared to how awesome this team is. So I guess that's my final message is focus on this team and how good they are, because the season is coming down the home stretch. We don't have many more games left with this team that has been awesome. And I think they deserve to just be laser focused from all the fans.
That's a pretty great point. That's something I was thinking about writing about. Just like, because this team has just been like so special and like so different. And like with a bunch of guys that have been around forever, like Gary Clark's been around forever. So has Evans. And like Kyle Washington really has it, but it seems like he has. So we've been hearing about him for 3 years, even when he was a red shirt. And I don't know, it just seemed like this is like the crescendo of like the last, like the Copain era.
Yeah.
Like all that stuff. Like once like this season ends, like Gary Clark's going to be gone, and like there's a, like it should be like a 90% chance Evans is like going to at least declare,
right?
Even if like he comes back, like it's almost like the end of an era, and like a.
It really is. I mean, this is like the culmination of everything that Mick Cronin has been building for since 2006. So, I think people have a tendency to get distracted, and I think I did a little bit last season. Don't overlook how fun this season is, because I mean, like you said, this is special, and I would hate for anyone to, you know, UC finally loses in the tournament, whenever that is, to go, damn, it's over. I really wish I had appreciated watching Gary Clark more, because that would be a terrible way to end the season if you realize that you didn't cherish how fun this has been.
I don't know personally. That's exactly what I did last year. It's like just watching the games, like you, it's like hard to not like look forward and be like, oh, this team is going to flame out in the tournament because of this, this, and this. Like, if you just like look at it like so far, like in advance, so we didn't really don't know what's going to happen. Nobody thought Xavier would make the Elite Eight last year. Like, and this team, like Copain and like Kevin Johnson, like weren't like the greatest players ever, but like they were like left a mark on like this half decade
right.
of UC basketball. And it seemed like their like last season was everybody like fretting about how they would be a low seed and how
I mean, just lose. I completely did that last year, and it's one of the reasons why I'm like urging people not to do it this year, because by the time I looked up and realized what was even happening, the season was over, and then I was like, okay, there's no more Troy Copain. And like you said, he wasn't the best player in UC history, but he was an awesome player and had such an impact on UC, and I don't think I enjoyed his senior season as much as I could have, because I was so focused on what was going to happen in March that I completely let myself breeze past all the regular season games where I could have been enjoying how fun that team was.
Yeah, definitely. And like now that they actually end the schedule like on a high note with like the level of competition, I think it would be easier to just like focus in on some of these games. Because like even like with Houston, like Rob Gray, I think this is his last season.
It's like, yep.
Going to be like a pretty big test for like everybody. Like Wichita, we've never played them before. It's like that would be pretty fun too. And then I guess the three games in the middle aren't as exciting. But like one of them is Senior Day. I mean, who can't get excited for Senior Day?
Yeah, I'm going to be an emotional wreck when Gary Clark goes out there for his senior day. I got tickets to that game, and I'm genuinely worried that I'm going to cry in my seat. I'm going to bury myself.
We can't talk about that. I'm not ready to talk about Gary Clark leaving.
I'm seriously, I'm terror. I already missed that kid, and he's not gone yet.
It's going to be, like, no matter what happens with the end of the season, it's going to be sad when it's over, and, like, he's not going to wear a UC uniform anymore.
I'm going to be heartbroken. That kid is my favorite UC athlete ever. I feel comfortable saying that.
He's like in my top five, like easily. Maybe top three. Yeah, I would say top three. Kenyon and Van Exel and him. That's my top three.
Yeah, I haven't been around long enough to have any guys from back in that era, but just with how good Gary is on the court and just off the court, is just the best human being ever. Like, it's, I just can't even express enough how much I love that kid.
And like being a four-year player and like just getting better every single year. Oh, now I'm like sad.
Ended on a sad note.
Well, thanks for joining me. Like, we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, let me know. I'm down anytime.
And go Bearcats.
Go Bearcats.